Access number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 22. Now, what about the other three exiles? That's Norway and Germany.
Yes, sorry. The other splendid places that we were involved with were, I've mentioned Norway, where the flying was really superb there. It was so completely different to fly in winter time over the mountains, and often it was linked with Norwegian and British troops up on exercise as well. And over those mountains in snowy conditions and off snowy airfields was really splendid. Now, most people know about the whiteout conditions, which normally occur as a danger to aircrew, when the sky and the murky conditions and the snow all meld together. But there's one other type of whiteout, surprisingly, which is when you're flying at low level, and this happened once to me, coming down all the way, redeploying back from Andøya back to UK through Sola, Stavanger. I always felt that every sortie was so important in terms of getting maximum training value that my own policy, which was completely different from most others, was not to go at high level, but to maximize the amount of training that you did. And we came down at low level all the way. And my number three then was Peter Albrecht, who's an exchange officer from the United States Air Force. He was the second one. Bill Alfrey was before that, but Peter had been in Vietnam already at least once, if not twice, and went back a third time off on Thunder Chiefs on the F-105s. And he was my number three, and we were flying as normal, about 2 miles apart, I should think, on that long leg, or certainly 1.5 miles apart, with a number four and a number two out beyond that. And all of a sudden, I literally was looking at him, and he just disappeared. And between us was a snowy peak, which neither of us had actually seen. And that was in gin-clear conditions. The other intriguing thing on that sortie, I remember, was that for at least a minute and a half, at a very critical stage, because I was leading, and again doing something where normally you redeployed at a high level and you'd obviously have more fuel reserves that way. But for a minute and a half at the end of this very, very long leg going all the way down to east of Sola or east of Stavanger, but a very memorable trip, for at least a minute and a half, which doesn't sound very much, but the map... you always read from the ground you're looking at to your map. The map did appear definitely wrong, or I was not where I thought I was, which was the very great fear I had. And that 90 seconds was a very long time when I thought, goodness me, I'm for the high jump now, because if all four of us have to eject over this inhospitable terrain because I've cocked up the navigation or something like that, there wasn't anywhere else to go with the amount of fuel we had. But as ever, the golden rule is to turn on time, and I did that. And as soon as we turned on time, and probably a minute and a half later, we were coasting out towards the islands where Stavanger was the airfield, and we were still low level, but very quickly the map was quite right, exactly where we were, and we went in to land, break and land at Stavanger. But I did feel then very much like the Pope often does to kiss the ground when I got out of the aircraft, because it was quite a responsibility. And partly because I was doing this non-standard thing that we were doing a real operational training sortie en route, on deployment. Enough about Norway, apart from saying what a splendid variation it was, and we did that at least once, if not more, every year.
What about, you mentioned Germany, what about the other three?
Right. Beyond that, we had El Adam, which we used as our armament practice camps, often just referred to as APC.
And
which
is El Adam near Tobruk?
El Adam, yeah, in Libya. And we'd go out to El Adam through Malta, which was Lucca, and from then it was a shortish leg down to Libya itself. And from Libya, we would get involved often with the fifth place, which was Cyprus, which was very useful again for us. Almost invariably, four of us, normally the senior people on the squadron, would do an operational strike against Akrotiri Range.
The so range. The other three were El Adam, Malta, and Cyprus. Is that right?
Yes, and we've got Norway to start with up at the top, Germany in the middle, reinforcing Germany. Reinforcing is probably the wrong word. It's just redeploying to Germany.
Stick to the
then
other three.
The fifth one after El Adam and Cyprus is Gibraltar, which came on stream as a requirement. I can't remember exactly when Gibraltar started, but reasonably early on, and I think we were about the second rotation, it might have been the third rotation down there, with 54 Squadron. At West Raynham, we had 54 Squadron with us as the only other squadron, and because of our role with frequent redeployments, we didn't overlap that much, in fact. I only remember operating with them probably less than the fingers on one hand, I think five or six times, even though occasionally we tried to do it in terms of having hoolies together, you know, 54 versus one, although we were very much in competition with each other, which affects what happens later. But coupled with those, the last thing I haven't mentioned was Lone Rangers, which were there was no need for me to go on that myself, and I think only sort of one or two people did during my time. But before that, the squadron had done a bit more of that, and that was reinforcing to some extent and getting to know the route out to Bahrain, because very shortly Aden was finishing.
But you didn't do that.
No, but when I was out in Aden, for instance, the person I took over from, Jerry Seavers, super bloke that I like very much, his four came through, and I can remember looking after them, hosting them there when they came through, actually from one squadron. It was rather an unusual coincidence, and took them down to the Chinese restaurant in Aden, in Steamer Point. But that was an example of something that occasionally occurred. And then there were loads of other exercises going on every month, and it was a very tight, packed program. The other thing to mention was that SNEB was just coming in, the 68mm French rockets, which were anti-tank.
Now, what do you think?
That's SNEB.
SNEB?
SNEB.
And what did you think of them in comparison to what you had before?
Well, they were very good in terms of their main thing was anti-tank. And, of course, really, the 3-inch rockets, if you dropped 16 of them down, could be effective. But the SNEBs were far faster. A problem with the 60-pound head rockets, the 3-inch rockets, we call them 3-inch drain pipes, was the vernacular we call. They did release at a very low speed, and they were actually dropping as they were igniting, and with the result that they weren't terribly accurate, even though, you know, 10 yards was probably something that you could normally get. And of course, if you were putting 16 of them down, you would not. That was the 10-yard element of accuracy. The 10-yard circle of error was for academic use. But obviously, if 16 of them went down, you got a fair chance of, if you were in the right place, to do quite a lot of damage. But in terms of anti-armor, the SNEB was much better. It was far faster to fire. And I was fortunate to lead the very first public use of SNEB in the Royal Air Force, and that was before the Queen. And I think it was 15 para were down, or a NATO college or staff people down there for what's largely looked upon as what we called a firepower demonstration. And that was down at Salisbury, because I can remember, even though, you know, if you practice the thing two or three times, there's no guarantee that things could be right on the day, but I was quite fortunate that when I did the run in over the IP and being given our target where it was on pull up, and the attack went very well, and the number two behind me and I with a SNEB was so fast that sometimes, and on that particular flight, because I got a dozen aircraft behind both with SNEB for me, and then there were some three-inch rockets behind that, and then I think the ones behind them were doing fixed gun attacks. I was actually able, as I was pulling up, which is a little unusual, but it was so fast, the SNEB, that I actually saw it hit as I was pulling up. And the bloke behind me, which, interestingly, I mean, he didn't tell me until 25 years later, I think, was actually involved with this business of hitting the wake as he was coming, my wake as he was braking itself, and being thrown a bit on his side, you know, even beyond that, almost upside down on that, because of the amount of jet wash and wake as you rotate and pull out. But the other thing that was new to me at Raynham was the use of skip bombing. We did dive bombing and skip bombing.
Now tell me about them.
We were training to use 500 or 1,000-pound bombs, but we did it with little practice bombs that were only 25-pounders, and little. They had little smoke things on them, but they had exactly the same ballistic characteristics, and we used to drop them almost like in a sort of tennis court area, and that was great fun.
What is a skip bomb?
A skip is we'd fire from 400 knots rather than 420. I'm virtually certain it was 400 knots that we used as a standard, actually over the target, and at 50 foot, and you'd be flying level, and that was called level skip, and you'd try and drop your bombs literally in the size of a sort of small tennis court area, and it was remarkably accurate, really, with the way that you had your bottom diamond and through your gun sight you used it, and one could regularly, because I think the scoring I've got for that on one squadron was 93%. That was seven times four, dropping four bombs with 100% and some 75%. But all that was this 3 out of 4 attack business for the academic. And the SNEBs I see were 52% that I had, and the 12 air-to-ground scoring attacks was 57%, with the RPs at just over 10.1 yards. But that was in all weathers, apart from the fact that, as I say, I'm taking the 3 out of 4 attacks, but at least it there was some measure of consistency there, because that encouraged you to fire in any conditions. You know, if there was 50 knot wind across, as happened once down at Pembrey, you know, a lot of people wouldn't fire then, but I always felt that you had to fire in every situation you could, regardless of the weather. I ought to mention the Queen's review that we had, and then the AOC's fly past and Bulbo every year, that would be part of the program that we would have, plus exercises. And what I didn't mention was down at El Adam. When we got down to El Adam, it was really a concentrated weaponeering practice camp, as APC stands for, Armament Practice Camp, and we were doing all 5 things. We were doing the air-to-ground, we were doing the 3-inch rocket projectile attacks with the old World War II rockets, and then we were starting with the SNEBs, and we were doing skip and dive bombing, and academic and operational attacks. And on both occasions, well, 2 out of the 3 times we went down to El Adam, we were also looking, even then, on something that was probably some of the most hairy flying I got involved with, and that was doing night ground attack with the hunters. It was quite a good idea. The idea was that we'd go in at the same time. At one stage, we'd link up information at night with a Canberra and be over the target at the same time as they drop what's called LEPUS, LEPUS flares, being dropped down to illuminate the ground targets. But to be quite honest, we started with 2 of us in a trainer, and only 4 of us on the squadron did it. I think both times. It was a very demanding thing to do, night ground attack in the Hunter with the equipment that we had or hadn't got, which was non-existent, you know. And it was slightly better when you had somebody acting as a safety pilot, but really our altimeters and that were not good enough, and the flares too, and the synchronization of it was difficult. But we did do night ground attack with both rockets and the SNEBs, but I think it was virtually proven to be not realistically possible. But the idea was quite good, because obviously if there was a tank park or something like that where accuracy wasn't so important, it was certainly worth having a go at, but not something that even experienced pilots would find it too difficult. But later on, with FLIR that came in, and it was lovely, literally sort of 15, 18 years later, to speak to the Harrier guys who preferred doing things at night, because of course at night there was less wind and it was calmer and it was easier to get high scores at night. The other things that we were doing, all the time we were doing a mixture of activities which the FGA-9 would give you that facility, and invariably we were doing at least 3 elements of separate elements, separate exercises on each sortie, sometimes 4, sometimes even 5. But we'd be doing low level, we'd be doing high low navexes and strikes. Almost invariably they'd be strikes. We'd be doing multi-strike exercises where you'd be striking several targets. We'd be doing low-level cine weave, we'd be doing high-level cine weave, we'd be doing high-level combat, not much of that, low-level combat, quite a lot of low-level cine weave. We'd be doing lots of forward air control practice for where you'd be helping as much as anything the cooperation between our army and Air Force people who are actually in the field to call you in to targets. We'd be doing lightning affiliation, which was great with the lightning squadrons, where the lightnings would bounce us when we'd go up to Scotland, and our reach was splendid. We'd go over to Wales, down to Devon, up to beyond Scotland, Orkneys, Shetlands, attacks in Northern Ireland, not too much of that, but a tremendous variety, and it was really invigorating, and we were very lucky. We had no accidents beyond that first one when, you know, it's a strange event. The bloke was by himself, at any rate, I think, as a singleton. And we had a lot of young blokes, and if anything, that was another factor that we probably did not have quite enough experience at the sort of middle and upper level on the squadron. We had, I think, three or four ex-QFIs who'd been creamed off themselves, but there was it was a very young squadron in many ways. But what was splendid was, even though this was a lot of demanding work, we didn't have any fatalities. I didn't mention we did night formation flying as something more. It was fairly special, the night formation flying, and other things we toyed about with were 0.9, and that was only again for the senior people, 0.9 mark. In other words, 9 miles a minute cross countries, not obviously at extremely low level at night, but at slightly higher levels. I probably ought to mention Gibraltar, because reinforcing Gibraltar was to do with the Spanish involvement, that they were laying claims to it, and it went right back, as you know, to the Marines taking it, the Royal Marines, and it's on their effectively their cap badge, the link going right back to the siege of Gibraltar, and I think it was the Treaty of Utrecht from memory. But the Spaniards were making things difficult there for Gibraltar, and that reinforcement to start with, one squadron had been down there almost a year earlier from memory, and then it had faded out, and then there became a requirement, and two hunters would go down there almost all the time and rotate. And what was of great benefit was if you used your imagination, you could do quite a lot down there, even though it was constrained, because you were just that one airfield at the end of the Mediterranean, so and all of Spain to the north, and obviously the only play area you had was the rest of the Mediterranean. But later on, we were able to use that to good effect, because on my by the time I'd gone down there twice or three times, the third time I went down, it was literally on purpose, because we'd already beaten the other squadron, number 54 squadron, on the Buchanan Trophy shoot, where even though we'd not been out to the APC, and I think they had just finished their APC, or quite recently had more recent experience, we beat them at the Buchanan Trophy shoot, which was really operational firing on ranges, with virtually the whole squadron doing it, or all the operational pilots. And we'd beaten them at that, but we were still behind on ours, which was another aspect of our flying. And I realised straight away that if I went down there with two aircraft in February, we could get a lot of flying, because with the and it was quite high value flying, if because there were a whole variety of things you could do with the Navy that were quite interesting. And I remember once with the Sixth Fleet, USS Little Rock was the command ship of the whole of the US Sixth Fleet, and I can remember how in many ways easier to deal with and easier to operate with the United States Navy were than our own Royal Navy, because sometimes, just to really add a bit of interest, we used to put bog rolls in the air brakes, and when we said goodbye after doing the normal affiliation attacks, and they were getting practice on high fast targets from their point of view with their guns and missile systems and what have you, but the Royal Air Force, sorry, the Royal Navy used to get a bit crinkly often, and we never would release them at high speed. I mean, it would, because it would be terrible to injure someone with a, you know, it wouldn't make a very good casualty report, would it, if you, somebody had been hit by a sort of supersonic bog roll. But the Royal Navy used to get quite sniffy about it. But the fastest repartee I ever remember was from the depths, the bowels of this USS Little Rock, because I'd just asked permission for a slow flyby just to say goodbye, and they weren't expecting what happens. And we released the, I just said, black brakes, go. And they literally had, we had them pre-streamed, you know, so that there'd be about 10 or 15 foot of loose sort of above them, because they plumed far better that. And no sooner had I made that call than this American voice came back quick as a flash. It was the fastest repartee I think I ever I ever heard and ever remember. And he said, "Black leader, gee, thanks. We'll return them after use," which was extremely which is extremely quick, because he'd no idea what was going to happen. And as I say, the Royal Navy used to get a bit, they thought it was a bit infra-dig, I think, that the Air Force were trying to have a go at them. But I think the Matelots liked it tremendously, but captains of the ships, I think, because the odd snotty signal would go back to Gibraltar, and we would have the odd problem there with the people that we shared the airfield with, although generally we had a good working relationship with them. But the people that were controlling us there were partly from another age in some ways, and from previous, because I remember the other aspect about Gibraltar, which I mustn't forget, is the southwesterly, the strong southwesterly winds there. You could land in some amazingly turbulent conditions, because it would be coming round the rock, and if it was a strong southwesterly, it didn't happen very often, but it was very memorable. And it was the only time you would literally take armfuls of throttle in a Hunter on the final approach, and you'd have to be ready to put literally inches of throttle on very rapidly. And then as soon as you'd got that power, you were seconds later, you were in the lull in the area, or the lee area, where there was less turbulence. You'd have to get it back again, and to avoid landing hot. And I remember, sadly, something very, very vividly down there, where the squadron leader, who was in charge of the operations down there, would not let me pre-brief and talk to my own wing commander, Ron Wood, when he came down, I think probably to take over or to visit. I think it was purely to visit. But he was going to be landing in these very difficult conditions, and the runway was wet at Gibraltar. That was RAF North Front. And there was no sweat, because he was coming in from Dechi Mamano. We went down to Sardinia often. There were two ways we went down to Gibraltar. We'd either go down through Dechi Mamano in Sardinia and then fly down the Mediterranean to Gibraltar, or we'd take the west route, which was refueling at St. Morgan, and then flying direct down from St. Morgan. But we tended to sort of alternate a bit, but often we'd go down through Dechi, the Italian Air Force place there. Even though that command would never tell us that if we had engine problem between Sardinia and Gibraltar, whether we were to go into or not Algeria, because in those days and the relations were not good with Algeria. But we never ever, even though we kept asking command and group what they wanted us to do, whether they wanted us to ditch in the sea, or whether they wanted us to, in terms of emergency, land in Algeria. But we never ever got a reply to that, and we were less worried about Morocco, obviously, than Algeria. But on this occasion, there was plenty of time that I could have briefed him, pre-briefed the the wing commander, my wing commander flying Ron Wood, about those conditions. And strangely, this squadron leader down there, we used to give him the nickname Prince of Darkness, because he did have some rather medieval views on aircraft operation, we felt, certainly as far as the Hunter was concerned. And we had a real argument about it, and he literally gave me an order to stay out of the top of the tower. And the obvious thing happened, that if I'd been able to pre-brief this chap, I could have talked him through the whole thing, ahead of it, and then while it was all happening. But I watched him come in on those conditions, you know, too fast, and then also late getting his parachute out on a wet runway, and it was only probably 5 yards that he had to spare at the end, because it's very dangerous for at the end of North Front, that runway, if you went off the end there, you'd be lucky not to to break your neck, and then of course you've got your ejection seat live there as well. And I very nearly flew at this bloke, because I was so wild that this whole incident had happened. It was to do, in a way, I think, with his sense that it was his airfield and all that lot. And I also
North Front.
Yeah, RAF North Front. But we always just called it Gibraltar. But it was an extended runway going into the bay. But it was long enough in normal conditions, there were no problems. But in those conditions where you've got this big gust that would come at you, and you'd have to put your power on, and then immediately the power went on, you'd have to pull it off again, otherwise you'd be too hot. And then you really had to get your aircraft down, touching down, and use your brake chute early. And it was just, that was an element in the back of my head, because we'd worked our jacksies off down there with the young blokes to get really good fulfilling flying down there, because other I know other people